Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
In this lecture, Rosalind C. Higgins, class of 62, discusses life as president of the International Court of Justice.
The first thing about life as president of the International Court is that a lecture becomes a non-lecture. So this is going to be more in the way of a chat by me with you rather than a formal dean's lecture. But I can't say how thrilled I am to be here. It's always wonderful to be here at Yale and still up there circling somewhere. And I think my friends here know that I never come to this country without heading up in this direction. This is still home for me over here. Now, I am sometimes asked, and so I thought it might be an interesting topic to talk on what life is like week in, week out as president of the International Court. And that's often coupled with being asked how does it differ from what you were doing before as a judge? And the answer is, I think, that being a president involves certainly some of the things that you'd expect, but also some things that are perhaps rather more unexpected in the sense that they're, I think, a little below the visibility line, and not only below the visibility line to people outside of the court, but I have to say to those in the court as well. And it's only since I've become president I've begun to realize that those ahead of me have had to take on a whole range of issues that the rest of us can be gratefully taken care of, but don't actually see ourselves on a daily basis. Let me start by just giving you a broad reminder of things that I know. In fact, you well know that we're a bench of 15 from every corner in the world, that we're elected by the General Assembly and by the Security Council, voting simultaneously. And whereas the work of a juge rapporteur or an advocat général as a single judge drafting for a bench may work marvelously for courts of a broadly common culture, that won't work for us. That's because as the UN's court, we need to bind together judges from remarkably diverse backgrounds. And we need, at the same time, to maintain the confidence of the nearly 200 members of the United Nations. It would not do at all for them to see that the work of the court, albeit in an initial stage, was in the hands of Judge X or Judge Y. We have to, and we have to be seen to, work in a deliberately collegial manner. There were elections held last autumn, and four new judges joined the court at the beginning of this year, and the current bench of the court is composed of judges from China, France, Germany, Japan, Jordan, Madagascar, Morocco, Mexico, New Zealand, Russian Federation, Sierra Leone, Slovakia, the United Kingdom, United States, and Venezuela. And that, I think you can well understand, really is a world court in every sense of the term. And it's interesting also to think about the range of background on the bench. I mean, obviously, all candidates for the international court have to be high experts in international law. But within that, there are obviously many diverse career patterns that are possible. And in numbers that will even to the mathematically challenged among you, obviously add up to more than 15, you'll see figures deployed that show overlaps, that some come from not just one background, but a background that has had three or four important experiences in that person's life. So there are nine on the bench who've been professors of international law at some stage. There are nine who've been diplomats, very usually at the United Nations for the country concerned. There are two who've been judges in international tribunals. There are three who've been judges in national courts. And there have been four who've had international legal practice as counsel and advisor, and a couple who've had significant domestic legal practice as well, albeit in the sphere of international law. So there's, I think, a very good mix of experience within the court. And I certainly welcome the recent strengthening of the practitioner end of the bench and judicial end, which on a range of issues, it's very, very useful to have that expertise. As for the president and indeed the vice president, they're elected by the members of the court themselves. It's not a rotating thing. It's they're elected by the members of the court themselves by secret ballot every 3 years. That election is in fact held on the day at which new members of the court elected at the triennial election I've just alluded to are beginning their term of office. There is something rather curious about this. Judges arrive on February the 6th, or a date very close to that, on that first Monday of February. They shake hands with everyone, and half an hour later, they're joining in the voting for a new president. On the other hand, it isn't, of course, quite like that. They've been in touch with their colleagues in the preceding seat, months between their election, between late October, November, and that arrival date. They've been talking with their colleagues to find out how those colleagues are seeing the issue of the presidency, and have had a certain time to get a sense of the issues out there in front of the court. What is, I think, also unusual is that when the president's elected, he or she slides immediately into the president's chair. In fact, the remainder of that morning's business, however prosaic it may be, is taken over and handled by the new president. So there's no transition period or president-elect or anything of that. There's a vote, and then you're on. Now, obviously, the president has to do the range of judicial things that come naturally with the leadership in a great court. Nothing surprising about any of that, though the detail of it all may be of some interest to you. Before a case begins, the president meets with the agents of the parties. as soon as possible after they're appointed. So a party brings a case to the court, or by special agreement, the parties jointly bring it to the court, or, as is true in our current case between Djibouti and France, one party brings it, invites the other to accept, the other accepts, and the case is up and running before the court. The registrar then tells the parties they need as soon as possible to appoint an agent and to indicate a place for service of documents. And as soon as that is done, which is usually rather rapidly and very, very often, the ambassador in The Hague, or the ambassador for those countries who don't have an ambassador in The Hague, the ambassador in Brussels, will be chosen for that purpose. And then there might be a joint agent chosen also for the more substantive things on which that team will need guidance. And I meet with those agents, above all, to try and get a sense from them for the first round of pleadings that they'll have, which is most usually a memorial and a counter-memorial, how long they each feel they need to prepare that. And obviously we're looking for times. The two times will be comparable, but we're looking for times that are realistic when you take that comparability need in view, and that also carries with it the thought that, in fact, the applicant state's been thinking about these things already for some time. So it's not starting from the minute it leaves the president's room. It's already started. So that can take a little discussion, and any other issues the parties may wish to bring to your attention. For example, if one of them wishes the case to be heard not by the full plenary, but as is permissible by a smaller chamber, that is the moment for that idea to be floated in front of the president and for the views of the other side to be heard. A chamber case will only come on as a chamber case if both sides are agreed that they want the court in that restricted composition. And sometimes we have to deal with curious questions such as the speaking order. Normally, if you have an applicant and respondent, that's easy enough. The applicant will speak first, the respondent will speak second. They'll normally have two rounds of oral argument each. Of course, I've been talking this far, you understand, about how long they need to prepare the written pleadings. We're way, way ahead of the oral. But sometimes when there is a case brought by special agreement, which means that both parties jointly have decided to come to the court, they will tell you right at the outset that neither of them is willing to regard itself as the plaintiff or as the respondent. And you can usually get them to agree who will put in the first pleading, which would be ideal, but usually we have to accept for jointly submitted pleadings, which the rules do allow, although the court has done its best to discourage that. But what is extremely difficult is to get them to decide who will speak first, although you indicate it's without prejudice at all to any burden of proof or being seen as the applicant or anything of the sort. And sometimes the president is required to decide who will go first, and please do not press me on how we make that weighty decision. The president is in charge when we come on to the oral hearings in charge of the case. But before you get to that stage, there's often the issue of late pleadings, or more usually, countries are rather good about adhering to written pleading limits, late documents coming in after the time at which they're allowed to come in. And when there's disagreement between the parties as to whether they may be admitted, again, this will be a matter for the court as a whole, and the president has to bring that knowledge, the attention of the court, and to guide the discussions as to what position we should take on that, and all the incidental things that happen during the written phase. Then we get to the oral phase. The president's in charge of those public hearings. In fact, we meet before we come into the court in a room adjacent to the side of the Great Hall of Justice, known as the Red Room. I have managed, since I've been president, to get the judges there earlier than they've been used to coming, so that we have a good time to discuss the various issues that do come up before us. And in a charged case, such as the Bosnia and Herzegovina and Serbia and Montenegro genocide case, there can be some drama between the parties almost every single morning of the case, with objections from the one or the other about this or that having happened or being about to happen. And that half hour in the Red Room in advance of going in is the time for the president to inform colleagues as to what's been happening overnight, what the problems are, what solution she sees as to handling it, what she proposes to do unless colleagues see some other better course. And that has been virtually a daily occurrence in the Bosnia genocide case. More prosaically, that's the time at which the parties will pass into the Red Room their batting order for the day. By that I mean who's going to plead that morning, the length of time envisaged. That allows us to decide the very heavy matter of what time we'll take our coffee break. And also another thing that goes on there under the hand of the president is the question of a first look by the judges at any question that another judge wishes to ask. In a small tribunal, this is quite usual in my own country, where at first instance we're a bench of one and Court of Appeal a bench of three. It's absolutely usual, and I know it's true in the Supreme Court and courts here, to have virtually a quickfire seminar going on between counsel and the bench. When you have a bench of 15, that really isn't practical if you are to keep control of the conduct of a case in a way that's fair to both the parties wanting to present their arguments. So we have a rather stylized form of question putting, where it's usually put at the end of pleading rounds. But it is a practice that a judge wishing or thinking of asking a question at that early meeting ahead of going into court will through the president tell the colleagues, I'm thinking of asking this question, and the colleagues will say either, well, my view, that might be better left till the second round because I think we're going to hear Barrister X speak on that issue, or whatever other suggestions might want to be made. At the end of the day, by the way, it's a responsibility for the individual judge. He can listen to the suggestions of the colleagues, but is, of course, at liberty to ask the question he wants and when he wants. There's a big issue out there in controlling the courtroom during a long and heavy case. On the one hand, there are those who say the court's got sovereign states in front of it. They must be treated with all deference and courtesy. They must be allowed to speak at the length and say all that they want to say. On the other hand, there are the more cynical among us, in which I include myself, who say, no, that's not a sovereign state there. That's my old friend, Professor Bloggs, there. He's acting for a sovereign state, but he's the one really with his hands on this case, and we don't have to be so overly deferential. And my view, that's already well known, is that the great privilege states have is in being able to rest behind the consent principle, in not being obliged, save within the parameters of that principle, to come to the court. An extraordinary state of affairs when you come to think of it operating in favor of sovereign states, and that really is privilege enough. And once they're in the courtroom, they are under the control of the court that has the duty not only to see equality between the two parties, but also to remember all the other sovereign states who are waiting in line also there for their cases to be heard. In the Bosnia and Herzegovina and Serbia and Montenegro case, we had 2.5 months of oral argument, and the court had to sift through vast amounts of documentary and audiovisual evidence, and we had a court witnesses for the first time since 1991. And as president, I had to oversee the examination, cross-examination, and re-examination of each witness. By that I mean making sure that the testimony being led in examination was the testimony within the area that we had been informed in advance the person was expert on or witness to, and not going beyond that, and making sure thereafter that the examination was conducted in a fair and impartial way. And there's also, of course, constantly, I've already alluded to this, the question of what can and can't be admitted in the court during these examinations or otherwise. During oral hearings, the rules in our court are rather less developed than for evidence of a written form, and there's no specific time limits, obviously, but that always leaves one side, the side whose witness it isn't, with the possibility that evidence will be introduced at that juncture of which it's had no prior knowledge. So there is a rule of practice as regards that, which says if evidence has not previously been cited as to be introduced, evidence that is readily available within the public domain may nonetheless be introduced. And we've had some very interesting questions during this particular case, the genocide case, as to whether what I would call minor judicial orders or even judgments in the ICTY, which are not yet formally published but are available out there on the internet come within that category readily, publicly available. And this is going to be one of several issues that, as a result of that case, I've asked the Rules Committee to take a look at in the future. This case has thrown up several very interesting issues for us, which, moving into our modern world, we need, I think, to have some rather clearer answers on for future occasions. Then we come to the deliberations and the drafting of the case. All judges sit on all cases, unless we sit on one of those chambers. I've mentioned chambers of five at the request of the parties. And the case goes under deliberation at the very moment that the oral hearings are brought to a close by the president. And it is the tradition, unless a case finishes at the very end of a day, that the first internal deliberations of the court are held immediately after the president declares the oral hearings closed. This is called an Article 3 deliberation. It has a limited purpose, and it's this: the president and the registry together prepare a list of issues. This essentially means, what are those key areas of law and of fact that the members of the court simply must look at in each case, that can't afford not to be thought about by the court? And that list, which is usually several pages long, 8 or 9 pages, is brought before the court immediately after the hearing is closed, and a couple of hours may be spent in making sure we've not missed anything, that all the key issues are there and are correctly put. The judges will then have a period of time to work on what we call the judge's note on a case. We've no longer for a decade or so done that in preliminary objection cases, nor obviously almost definitionally done it in interim measures cases. But on merits cases, it is done. This gives the judge the chance to sit down quietly and to start to work his or her way through all of this very heavy legal argument and data and facts that are before the court, answering this by reference to the questions that are out there, or indeed in any other way the judge chooses. That continues to be a duty for the president also. So that's quite a heavy task, doing that in addition to all the other things one now does as a president. Those notes then get translated into the French and the English, because we work on everything in the two languages, distributed to the colleagues, and after a pause of about a week, we'll meet to deliberate on the back of having seen what the first impression of each of the colleagues is. And the president obviously presides at these deliberations, which start from the junior judge in terms of seniority, who will offer his or her views and will work up the bench, as it were. Of course, it's for the president to decide if, on a particular heavy case, there should be perhaps a subject breakdown within that format. Let everyone have a first go in term at this very difficult topic. There can be variations on that theme. Now, the president has written his or her note as his or her own opinion, just as before. Though I must say, I don't write quite the same note as I did before. I write a less opinionated note, and sometimes on very difficult issues, deliberately indicating I'm open. My view at the moment is A, but I can see the merits of B, and I'm looking forward to hearing the colleagues, and so forth. I think that's simply the correct thing for a president to do, not to be too firmly wedded too early on. Mind you, I think that's a good position generally. I think all judges should try and remain as open-minded as they can for as long as they can. At the end of these deliberations, which can sometimes be quite animated, the president has to resume the discussions, not boringly by saying, then Judge A said this. This was followed by Judge B who said that. That would be too tedious for words. But by taking the key issues, which it's become clear by now, must find their place in the case, and trying to see whether there's a consensus on the one or the other, what the different streams of thought are, whether it looks as if we could do the following, provided we could change it somewhat to do this and that and the other. Trying to bring together, showing the colleagues that there are majorities that exist for this, the skeleton of a way forward. And I think one of the very difficult things for a president is to do this. First of all, in a way, in discussions that may have been heavily animated, in a way that all your colleagues will fear that's a fair enough summary of what's gone on. But secondly, in making sure you're not going to arrive at simply the lowest common denominator. That would be, even for a bench of 15, I think a very poor outcome. And a court has to be prepared, not on every issue, to go for the biggest majorities. Just for issues on which there can be a majority or a decent majority, and on other issues to have the feel, well, we could go this way or that way. Let's, in order to get more, do this. You have to have a feel for these things. And treading that line between the quality of the judgment and the confidence of the colleagues that all of their points are well taken into account is quite frankly a very a tricky one to tread. It's the president who suggests who might form the drafting committee on the base of the summary that's been given. The colleagues, though, make the final decision in the sense that they vote in a secret ballot. So the president may say, well, you've all been sitting here for the past week. My feeling is that those who could very well represent what's emerging as the skeleton of the way we're going to go could be judges X and Y, but you're at liberty. And well, in my experience, in 12 years, X and Y invariably are chosen. But I think it's important for the colleagues to know that those judges are not imposed upon them. And sometimes some different names do indeed come on to the ballot, and you know the disgruntled colleagues who have proposed those alternative names. Once the deliberation's over, the work of the drafting committee begins. The president is always on the drafting committee unless he or she is not a member of the majority. Then it will go to the vice president, unless he too should be in the minority. Then a third judge would be chosen. None of these has, in my time on the court, happened. The drafting work is very, very heavy work. There's no doubt about that. And the president allocates the work in a friendly meeting between the other two colleagues who are on the drafting committee. How much the president himself or herself will do will again depend upon factors, although the great bulk is done by the other members of the draft committee of the actual drafting. The president does all the coordinating. The drafts come in, there are meetings held at which the registrar and the senior members of the legal division are present, and the president conducts those meetings both to improve the text, to make sure that points haven't been missed, to make sure that points are internally consistent, to ask that we have a think again on issues that it's now apparent are not so clear. At a certain moment, a text that's ready for to go out to the membership as a whole goes out. The drafting committee hears back from the membership in a very detailed way. More meetings of the drafting committee, and then a draft judgment for first reading, as it's called, goes out. And again, those drafting meetings are once more chaired by the president. They're done on a paragraph-by-paragraph basis. They can be, depending on the topic, very animated or rather technical. It will simply depend. Some colleagues will try to use the opportunity to reopen things on which they may not have succeeded in the deliberations, and it's quite a the president has her hands quite full, keeping an eye on all of that and proceeding at a pace that on the one hand gives everyone time really to participate, and on the other hand is brisk enough for us to make real progress, keeping an eye on all of that. After that, there'll be a second meeting of the drafting committee, again work presided over by the president, to discuss what we heard, which of what we heard should be taken into account, which simply can't be. Second draft goes out, that's read formally, this time page by page. It's meant to be that second reading, just about whether it should be a semicolon or a comma, but it rarely is just that. And again, that is likely to be a further a further period of heavy work. The president also is in charge of the issue of incompatibility of functions under Article 16 and 17 of the statute. There are some suggestions as to the circumstances in which a judge should not sit on a present case, either where that judge has previously taken part as agent, counsel, or advocate, or something comparable, And also there are circumstances where a member, for whatever reason, feels he should not or she should not sit in a case. And it will be for the member to bring that issue to the president to have a chat about it. Normally the president simply announces to the court that this has happened, the reasons that Judge X will not sit. Occasionally it can be an extremely marginal issue, and the president will seek the view of the court as to whether the judge is really being excessively sensitive in this case or whatever the issue may be. And then there's the other sort of incompatibility that doesn't go to the question of sitting in a particular case, but what other functions a judge may engage in while on the bench. The rule rather baldly says, no, this is Article 60, no member of the court may engage in any political or administrative function or in any other occupation of a professional nature. It has, however, you read those words, been the case since the outset, and that includes a couple of formal decisions to that effect, that judges may sit on arbitrations. On the other hand, the practice has been to discourage that being widely done, to suggest that it might usefully be limited to very occasional interstate arbitrations. And as we are now a very busy court, this practice, while perfectly legitimate under our statute, is one to be exercised with great caution. There's a lot of administration too. This, I think, is part of the unseen face of the work of the president. On the one hand, the registry side of the court, the non-judicial side, is run by a registrar with the support of a deputy registrar. Our court has four, we call them divisions, and four departments and several more divisions, which are lower gradings, albeit all the work important. And the registrar is the first person in charge of all of that. But at the end of the day, the president is heavily involved in administration. First, because on what in UN parlance we call G grades, non-professional gradings, for example, court drivers or those physically moving archives around the building. All people very genuinely important to the work we do, but those are matters purely for the president. And then the P grades, the professional grades, they're for the registrar to recommend, but upon the agreement of the president. So the president is one way or another deeply involved. We obviously have certain internal procedures to try and make sure that these decisions are not made upon the whim of any individuals, whether the registrar or myself. But at the end of the day, that's where the decision has to stop. And sometimes there are factors that make this very complicated. The president presides at all meetings of the full court, and directing its work, supervising its administration. There's, at the moment, bi-monthly judicial and administrative meetings of the court on a range of judicial, technical, and policy issues outside of the specific case law. And there are also bi-monthly budgetary and administrative committees, a committee which I also chair, and that deals with all these personnel and comparable factors. I used to be chairman of the Rules Committee. Now Judge Awada does that, and the initial reporting on that is done to me and then goes into the court for its views. There are a couple of other, before I close, less visible things that I really hadn't seen at all and which turn out to be quite interesting. First of all, the court is under the special agreement, the 1946 exchange of letters that the court has with the government of the Netherlands. We have some special arrangements as the court's primary judicial organ, and we're accorded the status and privileges and immunities of ambassadors. And that has led to the president being the senior member of the diplomatic corps in the Netherlands, with all that that implies. So every week I have courtesy calls made by ambassadors, and that's very interesting, time-consuming, but very interesting, and one learns a great deal about a variety of things. And whereas I had before rather avoided going to annual national day receptions and such other delights of the diplomatic world, I do now go to them to represent the court. So 3 or 4 evenings a week at 6 o'clock in the evening, I am there with my glass of wine or orange juice, according to where I am at the particular embassy, again meeting with all of these ambassadors. It also means that as the senior diplomat, you are invited to state dinners. We have a very active royal house in the Netherlands, and in fact a royal house with a great deal of interest in our court. And Queen Beatrix has state visits from overseas, and there are invariably rather wonderful dinners given. And I now find myself attending these, and one of the things I need badly to do this weekend is to replenish my supply of evening dresses, if I can do some shopping here. It's all very well for the men with their white tie and tails, but one of the disadvantages of a woman president is that I need to keep changing my outfits. We also have occasional solemn sittings when we, the court, receive a head of state. We had, of course, our 60th anniversary solemn sitting earlier in the year. And by solemn sitting, I mean the whole of the diplomatic corps is invited, and we make a rather special occasion out of it. And I think our 60th anniversary sitting, which, by the way, you can see on our website, was a rather special occasion, and Kofi Annan came over, and the then president of the General Assembly. It was in the presence of Queen Beatrix, and some substantively interesting speeches were made. We then have the other form of state solemn sittings. We'll have one just as soon as I get back for the King and Queen of Jordan, who are coming to the court. These are very stylized affairs in which the president tells the visitor from that country what that visitor already knows about his country, and the visitor tells the court what the court already knows about itself. But this ritual seems to give a great deal of mutual satisfaction. And then we all go off and have a drink. And again, the diplomatic the diplomatic corps is invited to all of that. And of course, I should, in concluding, explain that as the major, the principal judicial organ of the UN, and as a main organ of the UN, the president is expected each year to speak to the General Assembly, to meet with the Secretary General, to participate in various meetings with senior persons at the UN in New York, and that season is upon me now. And over the next week, I'll be delivering speeches in the General Assembly, the Sixth Committee, the Security Council, the legal advisors of the Ministries of Foreign Affairs, and the Afro-Asian Legal Consultative Committee. And in addition, the president must also meet the chairman of the ACABQ and the Fifth Committee and the controller to start laying the ground for the budget, which in any given year is either being presented or is under preparation. We're in an under preparation year. We put ours forward a little later. So as you might imagine, it is a very, very heavily charged. Howard, let me just say this. I know you were kind enough to invite me over when you became dean, and I remember you saying that it's wonderful to be dean, but the whole purpose is to do something. And that's an idea I truly share with you. It is a fantastic honour, for which I am enormously grateful to my colleagues, to be president of the International Court of Justice. But this has to be, to take it on has to be because you actually want to do some things. And I told my colleagues at the outset that I want to maintain the high quality of the court's work while at the same time improving its work rate throughput to somehow to be able to achieve that. And we have, in fact, just effectively doubled the work schedule for next year, and I'm confident the customary standard will be maintained. I told them I wanted to improve to the very best level possible the relations with all the other courts and tribunals out there. The era's over for saying who is the senior court, whose law must be looked at by which one. We're all courts and tribunals in a common service. And now our task is to find ways of making sure that we deal with any problem of inconsistent jurisprudence, which, by the way, I think is a rather minor problem, but deal with it not through insisting on rank, but rather through each of us making sure we know what the other is doing. And with the help of Philippa, who helps me on so many other things as well, we've set up already a scheme with the ICTY for an exchange of relevant decisions and judgments to make sure that between the Yugoslav Tribunal and ourselves, we're always well aware on points of law of common interest where we're going. We're at the beginnings of setting that in place with the ICC, the criminal court, and those relationships are beginning to build up with other courts as well. And then I think it's extremely important that the International Court of Justice during this next period does not turn away from difficult issues, but maintains its primacy and respect by taking those on and answering them. And I very much hope and believe we will be doing that. So you had your plans, those are my plans, and I'm delighted to have been invited to share them. Thank you.
Rosalind Higgins delivered this lecture at Yale Law School on October 13th, 2006.